Hi, everybody. My name is Wade Mentor, as far as you know, and I am the CTO over at AdWorks. What better way to start a technology conference than with a survey, right? So how many people here consider yourselves sysadmins? This should be the easy part. I assume the three people who aren't are just looking at your laptops. How many people here consider themselves capital P programmers? How many people would consider yourself a programmer if you were any good at it? Right? How many people never answer questions involve raising your hands? That's called a paradox. You've destroyed the universe. Nice job, pal. It's always one in every class. Goodness. So this talk actually could be entitled "Why I Am a Terrible Programmer," and you'll find out some more about that here shortly. Another real quick survey. I want to get a sense of favorite programming languages here. English, good, me, do. Perl. Raise your hand if you consider yourself a Perl person. There you go. Python. Ruby. Shell. .NET. Thank you. Okay. You are my people. Awesome. So let me tell you a little, much like Humpty Hump said, I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself, then I'll tell you a little bit about this dance. So I was born in Cambridge, Virginia. No, you haven't heard of it. There were not many people there, no four-lane roads, no McDonald's, not a single luxury. So there was not much to do in my town. My dad ended up getting a computer from work, and because it's Cambridge and because it's my life, it ended up being one of the worst computers ever, the IBM PC Junior. With cartridge BASIC, rock on. So I had a computer, but not really. All my friends had Commodores, and I was very jealous of them. So I did a little bit of BASIC programming, but because I was growing up in tobacco country, I didn't have anyone to learn from. I didn't really have any sort of inspiration there. And there was no network in Lunenburg County, Virginia. One of my friends got a modem, and the only thing we ever did with it was prank call my house with modem static. My mom was confused, but so it was kind of a technological wasteland. So from age, birth to 18, my experience with technology and programming was limited to a couple of simple little basic things and working on the Tandy in my high school. So I went to college. I ended up going to a liberal arts college, the College of William & Mary, the second oldest college in the United States, and didn't really know what I was going to do. I thought I'd be a journalism major. Then I realized journalism majors don't get paid for anything, and, suckers gots to get paid. So I was trying to find something else that I enjoyed. Took a couple intro computer science classes. Kind of liked the concept, but I ended up just kind of coming into the computer science department at a time when they were transitioning from Pascal to C++. And I say if anything ruined me as a programmer, it was probably that year where my very first programming experience was in Turbo Pascal, and then they're like, nah, throw that mess away, now C++. What? So I ended up going from like Pascal to C++ to C, and it was really at that point in time that I realized I am an awful programmer. I'm not getting this. Pointers eluded me, so to speak. And I took, systems programming classes, and I took kind of build your own operating system. I still remember it was called Nachos, which was funny to me. And I was awful programmer. I was like, well, I'm going through this computer science program. I kind of like the computers. I'm not so good at the science, so what am I going to do? Turns out, there was this weird, kind of gnarled, old gray neckbeard who lived in the basement of the computer science department, shunned the sunlight, and he was the department system administrator. And of course, I look at this guy, I'm like, I want to be him when I grow up. Because why not, of course. I'm pasty, the sun doesn't act too friendly for me. But this guy seemed to have a really interesting job. He ran like the mail that came through the computer science department, and he got the web servers up, and he got all this interesting stuff to do, and he didn't seem to really have to kind of do all this C programming that drove me crazy. So I picked up some Slackware floppies and started hacking on Linux in my dorm room. There was actually something approximating an internet connection at that point, so I kind of got online. I started doing my own mail and stuff, and really started enjoying it. And I said, this is what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to be a system administrator. That's fun. And of course, as system administrators, we have to script. We don't program. How many people script instead of program? Yeah, that's right. I'm telling you, you're my people. So I picked up a little bit of Perl. I picked up some Bash scripting. I graduated from college, and my first system administration job after spending a ill-fated about 6 months as an IT auditor for Philip Morris, the cancer stick people, which did not go well. Although my stepmom loved the fact that if you worked at the Philip Morris office in Richmond, Virginia, in addition to your salary, you got a carton of cigarettes every week, whether you wanted them or not. Can't make this up, folks. So after realizing I didn't want to be a paper pusher, which is kind of ironic now that I'm a manager, I ended up going to NASA Goddard and working in their Earth Observing Satellite System. Yeah, there we go, Goddard. Nice campus, horrible traffic and green belts. Ooh, a little scary. So one of my first accomplishments as a system administrator using my newfound scripting ability for good, not for evil, was to blow away the password file for that particular project. The screams could be heard echoing throughout NASA Goddard. It took a good day to get it back online. This is what the literary world calls foreshadowing. So that, but I ended up learning a lot. It was a pretty cool setup. As a junior guy, I got a lot of mentoring. I got an opportunity to learn on some pretty interesting systems. It was an all IRIX shop, which in and of itself is a little weird, even for like 1998. And I was decidedly not a programmer. I feel like I should interject here and say that certainly I see the sea of glowing apples out there, and that's heartwarming. This is going to be probably a little more interactive talk than normal, than you're normally expecting. I've got about 10 slides, and beyond that, it's up to you to help me fill this time. So I'm going to be coming to you a lot. Remember, this is not television. I can see you. Cool? Okay. So I started programming. despite all my protestations to the fact that I'm not a programmer, I got into improv comedy. And for any of you who are in my improv workshop that I held yesterday, number one, thank you for coming out. And number two, this is relevant. So I joined an improv group and got into the sound tech stuff. So for my sound tech guy in the back, you know, props to you. And I noticed that at the point in time when I had joined this improv group, the sound portion of the show, and I'll say that the show is, oh God, I feel like a deer back in Lunenburg County now. So the sound portion of the show, and the show is two teams competing against each other, and it's kind of a sports format. Has anyone seen comedy sports in your city? It's around. We got one in the back. Awesome. And one right there. And one of the features of the show is there's a PA announcer, and they play music and kind of sound clips and stuff, and it's really quite fun. When I joined the improv group, they were running off of cassette tapes. And the way you played music between scenes or kind of got that just the right sound clip for a particular scene was you looked at the wall of tapes and you found the faded label that said, you know, whatever sound clip you wanted. You pulled the tape out. You popped open the cassette player. You hoped that the last person who played it had queued it back up to the right spot. You put the tape in, shut it, played it, and by that time the moment's gone. And it was not ideal. So I looked at that and said, I'm a Perl scripter. I hack in Perl. I wonder if I could make something that works for this. So over the course of about a year, I built this Perl TK desktop application, which looks as brutal as everything you're picturing in your head right now. And it was a very, very thin wrapper between a SQLite database and a MP3 player. But it was designed for you to be able to very, very quickly, you see something happening up on the stage, like, I've got a sound clip for that, let me find it, boom, play, done. And the audience was like, black magic, burn the witch, because, you know, how did you find that music? You guys are planning this out, how'd you find that? I'm like, no, it's just, you know, an easier way to find stuff than looking at the wall of tapes. And so I wrote this, and I wrote it for my improv club, and kind of, this was around the year 2000 or so, and in an early kind of attempt at open source community stuff, I put this out on the web. And shockingly enough, some other people started using it. And it ended up kind of spreading across the improv world. Now, as you see up there, this was 6,500 lines of some of the worst Pearl you will ever see. And I say that in full knowledge of how much bad Pearl has been written in the world. This is awful procedural Pearl, but it worked. And no one saw the code but me and the few people who dared kind of open up the repository and their face melted off like Indiana Jones, and they didn't look at it anymore, but it worked. So I wrote something that was embarrassing even by Pearl standards. I mean, I'm sure that if anyone, you know, who's good at Pearl, and there are plenty of people who are, looked at that, they'd be like, dude. But it solved a problem. And now 14 years later, from the time I first wrote that, it's still in widespread use in comedy sports clubs around the world. And I can't enhance it anymore. I've forgotten more Pearl at this point than I know how to do anymore. It's kind of a dead static project, but it still works. And that was kind of somewhat enlightening for me. And then, oh no, I lost. They taken my remotes. Let's see if I can get back on here. Yeah, if not, I'll go this way. Compute, we're a technology company, folks. Come work for me. I was getting a little bit bored with Pearl, or possibly Pearl had beaten me, one of the two. And I started, a friend of mine up in D.C. got me interested in Rails. So this was when Rails was kind of the new hotness, and like, you can blog all the things in 5 minutes, and it was fun. And so he and I started hacking on some projects. There were some pretty fun ones. There was one called Disco Stew, the IRC link bot that does not advertise. And it was just a little IRC bot that sat in an IRC channel that a bunch of us hung out on, collected links that we posted in there, and saved them for later viewing. So that was kind of fun. We were both XM subscribers at that point, big sports fans. We built a thing that would screen scrape the sports section of Sirius XM, or XM at the time's website, to let you find out which of their myriad channels your game was on. And, you know, again, this was kind of the early days of Rails. You know, DHH very much kind of came out from the start, and like, you know, test-driven development, you need to test all the things. We didn't do any of that mess. This was just, again, very kind of nascent Rails code. But again, it worked. We built something that actually made somebody's lives a little bit easier. I moved on to Rackspace Hosting, very fine company in San Antonio. I endorse them highly. And my job there was to build a bunch of internal Rails apps. So they had an internal development group that was very much the capital D development, agile, Scrum, buzzword, you know, get your story cards in, et cetera, et cetera. And building even the simplest thing would take months. Very well built, bless their hearts, but it would take a while. And so there was a small group that got spun up in a little division that I was in that would be like, all right, you need a tool to make your life easier. There's me, there was another guy who kind of used to be in the system side. We'll just whip you up a Rails tool that'll work. So we built some internal Rails tools. I went back to Rackspace. I worked there 2008 to 10. I went back there last year. One of my things, God forbid, is still actually running. It's a little thing I wrote, I think it was my first Rails project there, that would allow you to find a carpool buddy to ride to work. And that code is still there. I don't think anyone knows where it lives. I think it's a server under somebody's desk somewhere that's never been turned off, and it's running. But apparently people are still using it. And then I was there kind of right when the Rackspace Cloud started to become a thing. They bought Slicehost, pour out a 40 for Slicehost. And I wrote some of the early Ruby API bindings into the Rackspace Cloud APIs. Why? Because no one else was doing it. And I had some stuff I wanted to hook into that. So I wrote those bindings. Anyone want to hazard a guess how good that code was? Very. Not so much. But it worked, and we started to kind of get the engine going with people building things that connected to the Rackspace Cloud APIs. After a while, they were like, okay, you need to stop doing that. It actually became an official thing, and they took it over and gave it to people who were far better at this stuff than I was. And it still kind of continued to grow and continued to be an important thing. But the only reason it was there, at least at that point in time, was because some sysadmin was like, we need this. I can probably make that work, maybe. And so I built something. So I had a little side project going for a little while. It was a product called TeamSnap. Has anyone heard of that? I was there 8 years. Okay, we got like one person, so thank you. It's a tool for managing youth and adult recreational sports teams. So if you're not sporty, then you may not have heard of it. But it was a little project that was spun out of a web design company in Portland, Oregon. The guys had an idea over there how to build something. They got something written in PHP, a prototype. Took them a while, got it back. They weren't happy with it. I knew one of the guys through my improv connections. So he came to me and said, hey, Wade, you know, I know you're a tech guy. We've got this PHP prototype. We're not happy with it. Do you have any suggestions? I said, oh, well, you know, I've heard of this Ruby on Rails hotness. I'm pretty happy with it, building these little tools. Maybe you guys should check it out. So they went off for a little while. They came back a few months later and said, we love Rails. We're very, very happy with it. We're so productive. We threw away all the PHP prototype, trashed it. We rebuilt everything in Rails. We're really excited about this. We don't know how to run a Rails application. Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's what I do. I'm a sysadmin. I can run your infrastructure for you. So I set up the Mongrel clusters, the database, the DNS, the mails, all that stuff, pushed the button, turned it on, and we started getting a lot of really good press. So we started growing, we started getting profiled. They came back to me a little while later and it's like, hey, you know, we got so many people who want new stuff in TeamSnap. We don't have the bandwidth to do it. Can you program? It's like, well, I can try. So I became actually one of the lead developers on this thing. And we started out in kind of pre-Rails 1.0, and for a long time it was just like, the development team was me, a sysadmin, who can't program, a linguistics major from Stanford, who was our JavaScript guy, and kind of a big company legacy system programmer who was just learning Ruby. Quite the recipe for academically pure code, right? No, not so much. So we had together a bunch of stuff, and I really wish I could show some of this stuff to you because it's quite awful. And, you know, our user model is thousands and thousands and thousands of lines long, and there's duplicated code copied everywhere, and it's been kind of piecemeal upgraded from Rails pre-1.0 to Rails 2.3, and then we couldn't upgrade it anymore because it was so bad. And we kind of built some extra apps on the side to handle some APIs. We started a mobile app, and we're like, oh, we need something for this thing to talk to, so I built a Rails 3 REST API on the side. None of this stuff had any tests. None of this stuff was ever refactored. And we turned that just kind of jury-rigged code mess into a company with 8 million users, $10 million in investment, 55 employees. Our users didn't care how bad the code was. They cared when we couldn't fix stuff, and they cared when we couldn't add new features, but it was all hidden from them. And we got to the point where Andrew and Alan and I were no longer the programmers, and we had really talented developers who were then able to kind of come in and do an re-architecture and some rebuilding. Did they like us very much? No. Would we have had enough resources to hire them to rebuild this code if we had taken the time to try to do like great code and, you know, not shipped it? I would argue probably not. So despite the fact that it really kind of sucks to do this rewrite, we got to the point where it was actually sustainable. So I'm still hacking on a few other things on my own. Built this thing to kind of manage comedy sports championship festival registrations. I built a little tool. At TeamSnap, we used a thing called App Annie to email us that would give us stats about our apps in the App Store. They decided suddenly one day that, we don't really need to show you all the reviews. You don't need those. So I built a little thing to kind of scrape the RSS feeds where the App Store reviews are. I built possibly the dumbest thing I've ever built in my entire life, and that's saying something, this thing called Yakety Labs, whose entire purpose is you upload a Hyperlapse Instagram video and it puts the Benny Hill theme Yakety Sax behind it. Yeah, no, don't applaud at that. That's dumb. it's really quite silly. And then I've actually built something that I think is kind of interesting, and I think kind of represents some of the sysadmin as developer ethos, and it's a little product that I call Bus Duty. Duty. I'm 12. So it's a thing where, and my daughters went to elementary school about a mile from our house, and the school bus would leave at some non-deterministic time between like about 3:30 and 4:30. And we never knew when it was actually going to depart. So made it kind of tough for my wife and I to figure out when we're supposed to be at the bus stop to pick them up. So I noticed one day that some kind soul at the school had set up a Twitter account, and they were tweeting whenever a bus left. So they'd say green bus left at 3:45, red bus left at 4:15, whatever. So I was like, oh, I bet I could write a little script that would read that Twitter account, and if it sees a mention of my daughter's bus, text me. So I built this like 20-line thing that would just, you know, Twitter gem, Twilio gem, it would read the thing, it would text me. So I'm sitting there working, all of a sudden, doo-doo, oh, okay, bus just left, bus will be here in about 10 minutes, 8 minutes from now I'll walk downstairs and meet the bus. And the other parents at the bus stop were like, wow, that's pretty cool, can you add my number to that too? Well, sure, why not? Fun for everybody. And then they told some of their friends in the neighborhood who was like, hey, my kid's on yellow bus, not green bus, can you watch the yellow bus and text me? I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? And so it became a thing where it was kind of getting to be somewhat of an unwieldy mess, and it was all completely command line. There was no UI, so if somebody's like, hey, I'm going on vacation, can you make me not get text? I'm like, sure, typey. I was like, all right, this seems to have a little bit of legs, so I rewrote it as a Rails web application where a parent could go sign up at this particular school, choose which bus they wanted to watch, choose what track they were on, because it was a multi-track year-round school, so at any given point in time, three of the tracks of kids were in school, one was on vacation, and you don't want to be texted when your kid's not in school. So I put a little bit of logic and UI around it, opened it up to the greater elementary school family, and had about 200 and some parents sign up for it. And believe me, that when you start doing this sort of stuff, you find out what they mean by SMS is not guaranteed reliable. And so, God forbid that text does not show up to that parent. They will send you nasty grams about this free service that they don't pay for, that a parent wrote out of the goodness of their heart. Not that I'm bitter. And so I took that, and then my oldest daughter ended up going to middle school. My youngest daughter moved to a different school. So I've actually gone in and kind of refactored this again into a multi-tenant sort of thing where I can provide it to any school in the county or the state or the country. And just have to sign them up, and it kind of runs itself. Still no tests, because I can't handle test-driven development. My brain doesn't work that way. But it's solving a problem, and it was something I started small, built up, and now it's actually something pretty useful. This makes me laugh. Fair enough. Okay. So now we're getting into, I've told you a little bit about myself. Now we're telling you a little bit about this dance. And this is the part where I'm going to be coming to you, and again, remember, I can see you. How many people have heard of imposter syndrome? It's kind of a thing these days. Who has not heard of imposter syndrome? Awesome. I will attempt to summarize it in as best I can. I will probably get it wrong. If I do, then go look it up on Wikipedia. I'm not your Wikipedia. So imposter syndrome refers to the fact that as good as kind of we are and as competent as we are and as much as we're contributing, I think a lot of us, especially in technology, because technology is very big and complex, harbor a secret feeling that eventually someone's going to find out that we don't know what the hell we're doing. And we're just kind of faking it. And eventually like Scooby-Doo, the mask is going to be pulled off and we're just old man withers from the amusement park and not the scary zombie. And I think it's real because, objectively, I kind of look back at some of the stuff that I've built and I'm like, for somebody who doesn't code, I've done some pretty cool stuff. But then I look at it again and I'm like, but this stuff was awful. If anyone ever looked at it, everyone looked at the code, they'd just be like, you have no idea what you're doing. And in fact, I've had real developers that I've managed. I'm not going to say the name of the company, but it rhymes with TeamSnap. Look at my code and just be like, please don't ever touch a computer again. This code is awful. I wish you had never written it. And, you know, that kind of gets to you after a while, especially because with imposter syndrome, I kind of look at it and I'm like, yeah, they probably have a point there.
Well, of course, they have a job because you wrote that code.
Although they do have a job because I wrote that code, and I may have said that in somewhat of a snarky fashion at some point. On the advice of my attorneys, I can neither confirm nor deny that statement. But no, I mean, these guys are actually really talented programmers. I respect the hell out of them. They're far better at this than I am. And they're right. I mean, TeamSnap is undergoing probably a good year of a very significant rewrite and a refactor because we had kind of coded the application into a corner where it could not be salvaged anymore. You know, if TeamSnap had been started by real developers, would we have gotten to that point? Maybe. One of our smartest developers, you know, she was just brilliant. Doesn't work for the company anymore, but she was just one of the smartest people I've ever met, a great developer. She was, of course, complaining about the quality of the code that I'd written. And so we're like, all right, you know, here's a greenfield project for you. We need to build like a very light custom CMS. Have at it. So she went in there and she built some really complicated stuff and, you know, just subclasses upon subclasses and, you know, splitting things out into presenters and all this great Rails stuff that I have no idea what it means because I'm still just an MVC kind of guy. And so she built this thing and it's like, all right, you know, that's running. Now we need to make some improvements to it. Can you make some improvements? And she's like, I'm going to have to rewrite this whole thing. This code is crap. You wrote this. This was your stuff. This was your greenfield. You know, I can do it better stuff. So I don't think it's just me. I don't think it's just sysadmins. I mean, I think even really talented developers write stuff and they're just like, bah, I need to rewrite it. But, you know, I look at it and I say, you know, why did I write this stuff? You know, why couldn't I have spent some more time on it? Why couldn't I have, you know, studied some more, learned some more best practices? You know, I wish I was a little taller. I wish I was a baller, but I'm not. So why do I keep on doing this stuff? Why do I keep on building this code that I am somewhat embarrassed of? For me, I think it's because I personally see, in most cases, technology as a means, not an end. If you're in the business of writing very complex libraries and packages like that, this may not apply to you. But for me, the purest, cleanest, best, most well-tested, academically amazing software written in the world doesn't mean anything unless it's actually solving somebody's problem or making some sort of contribution to the real world. The worst script I've ever written, I am happy when it actually solves somebody's problems. If it makes an improv show run faster, if it gives someone a laugh at their hyperlapse video, if it helps a parent get to the bus station on time so that their kid's not just sitting there waiting out, I don't care how good the code is at that point in time. I care later when I have to kind of go and fix stuff. But I don't care at that point in time. And I feel like us as system administrators are uniquely gifted in that regard because I've always seen us as the problem solvers of a technology organization. Some of us are better programmers than others. Most of you are probably better programmers than me. But I think for our tribe, we go into any sort of situation like, how can I make this better, stronger, faster? How can I write a tool that will obsolete the sales guy and replace him with a very small shell script? Because we've done that before. My suggestion is that take that mindset and apply it to solving problems outside of the system arena. So I had dinner Monday night with an old friend of mine from Rackspace who's moved up here. He's kind of another ops guy from back in the day. And we were talking a little bit, and he said, you know, hey, my daughter and I have come up with this great idea for an app, and it's very simple. You know, she wants the world to know when good things are happening. So we've come up with this concept of an app where if you see kindness happening in the world, you would pull out this app, you'd hit the shiny red button, and, you know, something would happen, like a marker on a map or something. And then you could see kind of where in the world people think good things are happening. He's like, but I don't know. I don't really feel like I can build that. It's like, build it. Try it. That's a really cool idea. And don't judge yourself prematurely about the code you have not written yet, build something. If what you build is good and it's useful and it catches on, you'll have the opportunity later, either yourself or someone more talented than you, to come in and fix it. If it doesn't catch on, then at least you've tried. You've gotten something out there. You have built something. You've tried to make the world a little bit better place, and you weren't kind of weighed down or kind of sent into a corner by prematurely optimizing stuff that is never going to work. For us as technologists, the code that you don't write isn't going to change anything. The code that you do write has the potential to. So here comes the initial rebuttal. So the thing I don't want you to take out of here is the fact that I'm saying, go write awful software. Because then I might not have a job anymore because I'm hiring developers. And like, go work for this guy who says you should write bad software. No, not so much. If you have the ability to write good software, do it. By all means, write the best software that you can. For me, the best software that I can write tends to be untested Rails MVC web stuff. And I've tried learning test frameworks, I've tried doing all this other stuff, it just doesn't click with my brain. So I have a choice. I can either stop programming, because I'm obviously not getting it, or I can continue just writing the stuff that I know how to write, and hopefully some of it's going to work and some of it won't. Don't put that doubt filter in your head before you even start writing stuff. Have any of you had an idea? I mean, maybe this is just me. I don't know. Have any of you had an idea for something like, oh, I wish I could build that, and then you're just like, if I did it, it'd probably just kind of be a giant hack. I have. Has anyone else done that? Did you end up building it, or did you? Who built the giant hack, and who didn't? Who stopped yourself? Yeah. No one cares what the code looks like, except for you and anyone who has to maintain it after you. But screw them if they can't take it. Screw them if they can't take a joke. If you can take that step to actually building something, to putting something out there. To risking that kind of shame and ridicule from the better programmers in the world, you're probably doing something that they couldn't do. Because, you know, the inspiration for the idea is just about as much of success as the actual implementation. So what can you do if you're an awful programmer like me? Read code that people write that is actually good, that you consider good. Try to find a good developer, get them to pair program, get them to code review with you. That'll at least kind of get you up on some of the more modern stuff. Testing is important. I say that as someone who never writes tests, so, you know, empty as that may be. Try to get up on tests. There's a lot of really good stuff going on about that. And, you know, push yourself to get better. I mean, I've moved into, you know, this will not be shocking territory for anyone who knows what they're doing, but I've moved into a lot of async background jobs, and that's kind of fun. I've taught myself that, so yeah, my code is slightly improving. And when I try to write something, if I try to look at something like, you know, here's the presenter paradigm, and you know, here's concerns and all that, and I'm just like, I don't understand this at all. I try not to get too down on myself, because I can build stuff that actually works. So love the fact that you're writing bad code. At least you're writing. A lot of people aren't doing that. We need more people in the world writing technology. And so now comes the Q&A portion. It would make me very happy and probably feeling less alone in the world, and my heart would grow 3 sizes, if we could have at least a few people here in the room share your awful code. You know, tell us about the thing you wrote that you're very embarrassed about, but actually helped. So yeah, I think the mic's on right there. If you could hit the mic. Share. Remember, we are all supportive of sysadmins writing bad code here. There's going to be a lot of love in the room.
So there's going to be a collective sigh now. I wrote a Nagios, a comprehensive Nagios check for IBM Tivoli TSM.
Ah, wow.
Right?
TSM, nice.
Yeah, anything from drive status to wasted space, right?
Right.
It's a monolithic 3,500 lines of Perl. It has functions.
Good. Good. Yeah, functions.
It even uses a dispatch table.
Nice.
But it works. It keeps Central IT and King Abdullah University of Science and Technology kind of honest about the drives being offline.
Good.
Or tapes mysteriously moving between libraries. But, you know.
Thank you. All right.
And by the way, if anybody can please help me modularize it, I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you. Ah, bad code. We love it. Yes, sir.
So I wrote a script that does that takes a bunch of data sources for doing some accounting and usage monitoring, and it is a large bunch of Perl called the Baconator, and it is just awful.
But it works. Thank you. Doesn't this feel good to get this off our chest, folks?
So when I first started doing any kind of real programming in the, you know, used by other people world, I wrote a whole bunch of stuff for trying to do some data entry things in a more automated way because everybody on my team was constantly getting repetitive stress injury because of a lot of mousing and a very terrible Flash app that everybody had to drag around.
But you repeat yourself.
Yeah. but it turned out that the thing that I wrote something in a language that is called AutoIt, which not everybody may know, but it's a Windows, like, lives on top of the COM layer in Windows and, like, fucks around, like, replicates mouse clicks and keyboard presses and things like that. And what I wrote was a little tool that allowed somebody to basically drag and click a window over a certain part of their screen in order to take a snapshot of it. And then be able to save that somewhere and then be able to redo it over and over because everybody on our team had to take pictures of a website that would always appear in the same size and the same placement on your desktop and have to take a picture of it like all the time.
That sounds like a Frankensteinian hell.
It was. but the funny thing was like all of the stuff that I wrote for trying to handle the data entry stuff, which I thought was like good code, got thrown away pretty quickly. The snapshot code, it's 6.5 years. I'm told it's still used today.
Yes.
So, you know, and now I work at Amazon. So.
But it worked!
And it worked.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, we got time for a few more sharing stories here.
My name is Toby, and I wrote MRTG.
Yeah!
And 20 years later, I still get email from people who actually use it.
That is awesome! That makes me happier than it has any right to.
It's a hard one to follow up on. Hi, Wade. My name is Corey, and I've written bad code.
Ah, that's a shame.
When I was a grad student, I wrote an HPC cluster visualization tool that made little fish swim around in a fish tank when jobs were running on the systems. Looked really cool. I hard-coded in straight C the OpenGL triangles that were used to draw every single thing in that fish tank.
Damn, son.
And some poor grad student after me had to take it over after I left.
But it worked!
Yeah. I ended up building a inventory management system in Drupal. I had to hand upgrade a couple of modules, not knowing a thing about PHP. I basically just kept coding until I stopped throwing errors. yeah, but the beautiful part is I built the application, got it working. I was told to stop doing it. I stopped. And then 6 months later, when they needed to move the data center, they came bugging me for could you fix that? Could you send that up again? So, yeah, thank you.
But it worked. That's right.
So, hands up if you use Cobbler for deploying systems.
Any Cobbler users? Got a few.
Yeah, so hands up if you actually like the web UI. I'm sorry. So, if you're not familiar, it's a multi-click process to spin up a new system, get it to Pixie boot, and do whatever just to get your OS installed to generate kickstart files to install your OS. Well, if you're on a data center floor and you've got like a barcode scanner, you can just be like, oh, MAC address here, and... well, I have to click through five different things to get it done. I got it down to a one-click UI, enter the host name, enter the MAC address, but it's a giant pile of garbage because Cobbler's XML RPC API sucks. Sorry if there's any devs in the room, but it sucks. It rsyncs everything back and forth, but it works, and it just... It's a Python. I did it in like Python Flask and AngularJS because I'll learn the shiny for this. But hey, it works.
But it works.
Screw around with random technologies. You can make or screw around with random frameworks. You can make something useful.
That's right. It worked. Yep. Thank you. All right, last couple we got here.
I'm Fletcher. I wrote my first Django web application to schedule help desk employees, and as one example of the horribleness in it, every user profile has a dictionary with every day of the week and then a 30-minute slot for availability. It's just hundreds of lines of just 30-minute blocks in a dictionary.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And now multiple departments at the university are using it.
Yes.
I hate it.
Yes. Hey, feel the hate.
So back in the day, I worked with Oak, which was the predecessor to Java, and decided to do a distributed database system where it would query a Microsoft Access database, an Oracle database, and a MySQL database.
I think I just felt the shiver of death go over me.
Yeah, so I got it to do one query, and they gave me a master's degree. So.
Yeah! All right, so thank you for sharing your awful code, and hopefully the applause makes you feel like it was worth it. We're sysadmins. Go build something. Brush off the haters. Have some fun. Make the world a better place. And if you want to find me, I'll be doing office hours. If you want to find me later, look for me. Thank you so much for coming out. Go write some code.